This is the State of Things. We are live from the WUNC studio at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stacio. And as the capital city of North Carolina, Raleigh gets a lot of attention as the seat of power. But in the last 10 years, the community itself has undergone something of a renaissance. Downtown was once considered a virtual dead zone. It is now a vibrant arts and food scene. The city is often named the best to live in the country, often one of the best places to work. So it's fitting that Eno Publishers added the capital city to its 27 Views series of books, the latest called 27 Views of Raleigh, the City of Oaks in Prose and Poetry. And some of the contributors will be at So-and-So Books in Raleigh on October 23rd. In the meantime, they have joined us here. And we have some of the writers, Scott Hewler, local writer, former Piedmont laureate. Scott, welcome back. Good to have you here as always.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
June Spence is the author of Missing Women and Others, a collection of short stories, and Change Baby, a novel, and also one of the contributors to 27 Views. June, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Hi.
NC State English professor and two-time Nebula Award winner John Kessel here with us as well. Welcome back, John.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Frank.
And Sheila Smith McCoy is the director of African American Cultural Center at North Carolina State. She is with us as well. Welcome back, Sheila.
Good to see you.
I should tell you that we are live streaming video of this show, so you can go to naturalsciences.org, click video down on the left side, and you will see this whole bombastic review of the city's events. June, let me start with you. You were actually born in Raleigh. What does it mean for you to sort of look back in a city that has changed so much just in your lifetime?
Yeah, well, and it's in a very short amount of time. I know that there was a good 10-year span in there in my 20s where it went from being exactly like how it was in the 70s to a completely different place. And then in sort of the years after that, I would come and go a lot. I'd live and work different places and always come home. My family's here. So it means a lot. Scott and I used to tell friends that this was a great place to live, but I wouldn't want to visit. And obviously that has changed a great deal. But it's I love that I'm from here. It means a lot to me to be from here and to live here.
We should point out that you and Scott are married to each
yeah.
other.
Yes.
And when you say that it was what it was and then it became something completely other, how would you characterize what it was and what it became?
I think of the Raleigh I grew up in as a very working and middle class town that was up and coming, and I think my parents were very emblematic of that. They were both workers and strivers, and they really wanted to make something better of themselves, and they were, I think, part of a sort of chunk of people doing that, surging ahead, possibly the last generation to do so in a mm-hmm. while. And they sort of made the migration over to the new parts of Raleigh, and I sort of see in them the changes that began. My dad, although from here, became part of the RTP scene. He was a mechanical engineer, so he worked for Northern Telecom, ITT, for many years. So that was an interesting – we really saw that, like, suddenly all these people with strange accents came down here. And
no knowledge of collard greens.
And thought that we were strange. So that was a part of – a lot of the changes that now are just part of Raleigh and Raleigh culture were happening.
Tell us about your contribution. It is a startling one in a lot of ways. It's a wonderful contribution. And it reminds us that sometimes people get nostalgic about the good old days when we were all one family, but every one of those families had a little secret.
Yeah, and I'm guilty as anyone of being extremely nostalgic because we now live in the neighborhood where my grandmother lived, where my dad grew up, in the Five Points neighborhood, and it's a lovely, charming, full of beautiful bungalows, and it's seriously gentrified over the years. It's a lovely place, and it's meaningful to me to be there, but the meanings are very shaded because it was not necessarily a happy place for my father's upbringing. The part of the neighborhood where we lived was, or where he lived and where we live now at the time, was a much more sort of hardscrabble place. As our kids have started to grow up there, my dad has come back when he visits, and we walk through the neighborhood, things just come back to him. And so over the years, I've heard a lot of things that I never knew. And that this essay sort of comes out of that.
Well, I'd like you to read for us, and you may have to set it up a little bit more, mm-hmm. but if you would read for us, it'd be great.
Yeah, there's a little short excerpt out of here that kind of gets to the heart of what the essay is about. I'll read it first, and then we'll see if we need to put it in some context. My father roamed Five Points throughout the 40s and 50s with his older brother and a group of boys who called themselves the North Side Gang, when it was still Raleigh's North Side. Boys as young as 5 and 6 tagged along with elder boys to throw rocks, smoke cigarettes, explore the stormwater tunnels, and smash the bottles of grape pop that remained in heaps by an abandoned plant, after first prying off the caps and drinking the contents. My father still carries the scar of the skin graft he got after flinging a broken bottle. As the jagged glass left his grip, it took the tip of his finger with it. He and his friends shot steel-tipped arrows straight up into the sky and dared each other not to look as they came back down. The boy who did look up was scorned as a chicken, though he lost an eye. A favorite prank was to surprise drivers on Whitaker Mill Road by placing a cardboard box in the street with the smallest boy concealed inside. They accidentally set ablaze a grove of trees with an oil filter they'd scavenged and lit, intending only to heat their fort. They were all reckless, bordering on calamitous, but my father would get to wondering when God might hold him accountable, and that stayed his hand when the others stole from the neighborhood grocery or worse. My uncle knew no such limits. He was among the older kids who cranked up all the school buses in the dead of night and let them bash into each other. Later, he stole cars and drank his way out of the Navy.
June Spence reading her contribution, Intersections, to the latest in the collection of 27 Views, this 27 Views of Raleigh. So tell us a little more about your uncle.
Yeah, my uncle, from those auspicious beginnings, and the essay addresses this, that he, as a young man, got involved in a pretty terrible liquor pill field spree with another man, and made their way to Greensboro, and three people died along the way. And he spent the rest of his life in prison. And that was the big shadow that...
And you didn't know, and you had not always known about that.
Well, no, I actually did know that my uncle was in prison until I was in my early 30s when he died. And so I knew about that, but I didn't know the sort of core about that, the way that they ran in the same circle, but the way my father seemed to have things that stopped him, but nothing seemed to stop his brother.
John Kessel, let me ask you, because you and Sheila both teach at State, and you're from where I'm from, not from here. Does that change your view of this place when you hear other people talk about Raleigh and these neighborhoods and the way it once was?
Well, I've been here going on 32 years, so it's half of my life. But still, I do feel like I'm a Yankee who came down here with all the other Yankees. And that gives me a kind of double perspective, because I really like Raleigh and I like the neighborhoods, and I've learned a lot about its history and the families and the way things are done. And yet, on the other hand, I'm still, I think, at some level an outsider, and try to see it in a perspective of the whole United States or whatever. I don't know if I have any wisdom about that. I'm always being sort of caught short by some things. I'm still being surprised by things that wasn't like that where I grew up, okay? I don't like to be one of those Yankees who says, we did it better up there, okay? Not at all, okay? But it's different, and difference is interesting.
We know how to shovel snow better than they do. That's one thing.
That's right. One of the big complaints is always, oh, they don't know what to do when it's snowing.
Yeah. They do, too. They stay inside, which is exactly what you should do. What's wrong with that? Sheila, you are in the position of having, been from here. You know Raleigh growing up, and you're also an academic. I mean, does that change the way, once you sort of take the scholarly view and the big view of a place, does it change the way you look at your hometown?
It really made me appreciate it a lot more, I think, in many, many ways. I've lived in Raleigh most of my life. I was away for 8 years. But I had a very interesting sort of relationship to Raleigh, because our home was actually about 15 feet from the Raleigh city limits. And for us, that meant that we were what was called the outskirts. Our neighborhood actually used to be a peach orchard, and it actually had a German name originally. It was called Ramcat. And why that became critically important is when the busing and desegregation was ordered, because we were not literally that those few feet in Raleigh, we were actually taken to Cary High School, where we had an interesting desegregation plan. So it made me appreciate what Raleigh meant for me in many ways.
Where is that neighborhood now?
It's still there. It's on the corner of Tryon and Sadie Hopkins. And when growing up, it was on the corner of Holly Springs and Chavis Drive. It moved addresses, but not physically.
Well, on the State of Things today, we are talking about 27 views of Raleigh, the city of oaks in prose and poetry. NC State at NC State, Sheila Smith McCoy is with us. She is the director of the African American Cultural Center at NC State, also English professor and two-time Nebula Award winner John Kessel. June Spence, author of Missing Women and Others, a collection of short stories, also a novel, Change Baby, and Scott Hewler, a local writer and former Piedmont laureate. We'll be back with more conversation on that, but first we've got some music of Green Sky Bluegrass. They're going to be with us in our final segment. We'll hear more from them, but here they are now on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio Broadcast Service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here they are, Green Sky Bluegrass. This is the State of Things live from the WUNC studio at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. I'm Frank Stachow talking today about the book 27 Views of Raleigh, the City of Oaks in Prose and Poetry. Scott Hewler, local writer and former Piedmont laureate, June Spence, an author, NC State English professor and two-time Nebula Award winner John Kessel, and Sheila Smith McCoy, director of the African American Cultural Center at NC State, all with us. We're streaming live, too. If you go to naturalsciences.org, you can find the video section there on the left side. Click live streaming, and you can watch this program as well as listen. And then we'll find out if we're ready for TV, Scott. I don't think we are.
Are we committed to this fiction that there's a band here and that wasn't just us playing?
This is what I used to thought radio was, but the band would go from, and the Beatles were actually there at WYSL, and then they went to WGRQ. So tell us about your contribution here, because you take a nostalgic view, but also what happens when you get over your nostalgia, in a way.
Yeah, it's funny with all these fabulous musicians here in the studio with us and also all over town right now. Mine is a piece about music, which Raleigh, where I think many of the listeners to the show will be familiar with the band The Backsliders, who I'm thrilled to say are playing actively again right now. So my essay is a complete lie now, but I wrote it about a period where they were no longer active and they were occasionally playing, you know, a show, a one-off show here and there. And they were active and central to a part of Raleigh when Raleigh was really sort of finding itself and waking up musically, that during the whole alternative country 90s, Raleigh was a center with the, especially the Backsliders, and Whiskey Town was there and several other really terrific bands. And for the first time in my life, my favorite band in the entire world was people who I bumped into at the liquor store or at the grocery store, or when I went to another show, there they were hanging around the back listening to another band. It was an amazing thing to me because I was used to, you know, oh, I really like Steely Dan or Sheryl Crow, somebody who your relationship with them is a plastic disc. And this was my relationship with them, was being in the same room with them, living in the same city with them. And I felt like they were expressing a Raleigh reality that I connected with so profoundly, and especially it was a sort of alternative country band, so there was a lot of songs about heartbreak and things going wrong, and I was going through a period of my life where I was experiencing a lot of heartbreak and things going wrong, and there was they had this one wonderful song called Crazy Wind, where they talk about taking a radio and breaking it and throwing the pieces in a boxcar, and it'll ride to Mexico and let the truth come drifting back on a crazy wind. And I live, as June was saying, we live in the Five Points neighborhood, which is this wonderful mixture of all sorts of things all together, the way smaller towns can be. And we're real close to the train yards, and we hear the trains bumping around, and I would think they were writing songs about the same trains I hear, and it meant so much to me to feel like I was part of that.
Will you read for us?
I will. This essay about the Backsliders starts with me sitting on my front stoop in a nice, beautiful Raleigh summer afternoon, just wondering what to do next. From somewhere, south, maybe westish, I heard the opening riff of the opening song of the Backsliders throwing rocks at the moon, the CD that never left my carousel that summer. Motivated, I began walking toward the sound, figuring I'd meet a neighbor with some good taste in music. Maybe we'd have a beer. One of the delights of living in a small city, though, is that everything is kind of mixed up together. In one direction, a 5 minutes' walk carries me into the city's richest neighborhood. In another, 5 minutes puts me among renters barely out of school. Head south, maybe westish, and I'm among warehouses and cement plants, rail yards and welding shops. Following the twang of the guitars, I turned down a gravel road toward the train tracks and found Dan and Bill's Automotive. Sign, for Dan and Bill's Automotive, use Second Gate. If Second Gate is closed, so is Dan and Bill's Automotive. The second gate was open, and 20 or 30 people milled around in denim and cotton, smoking cigarettes, gripping sweating long necks, and kicking up a little dust as the evening deepened. And that wasn't some Backslider CD the neighborhood was hearing. That was the Backsliders, grinning in the dirt parking area in front of the loading dock, playing for those 30 people like they were their 30 best friends.
Scott Hewler reading from Backsliders, his essay in 27 Views of Raleigh. That business about connecting the cultural and arts scene as the real kind of visceral connection between you and the city. It's not really the street signs or the Walgreens that's going to do it for you, right?
Right. No, absolutely. It's whether it's the bookstores or the radio station that you're listening to, the local radio station, which is Raleigh is, thrillingly to me, a really local city. It's a city with not just neighborhoods. I moved here from Philadelphia and I grew up in Cleveland, so I'm used to that urban Eastern European thing. This is a very different feeling down here, but it has the same kind of neighborhood centrality to it. And I think that there was a lot of suspicion before, and as John was saying, all these Yankees coming down here. And now I think that Raleigh has grown large enough and sort of it has achieved self-awareness, and it celebrates that multicultural sense and that different neighborhoods have different perspectives and different ways of seeing things. And so you get music that has a Raleigh sound to it, or, you know, and that's different than a Durham sound.
And a Chapel Hill sound.
Right.
Chapel Hill sound.
And we love that, and to be so close to each other and to be part of the same thing. But Raleigh is Raleigh. When I moved down here, I was moving to, in 1992, I was moving to the Triangle. I live in Raleigh now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and John, when you moved here, you were moving to the South. Sheila, radio stations play an important part in your story, too. Very
indeed,
cool thought
indeed.
Of this. AM, daytime-only stations, right?
Mm-hmm. WLLE played only during the daytime because it's FCC license prohibited it from playing after dark. So it's a very interesting time in terms of Raleigh's musical history because there were people of color, African Americans, who would listen to WLLE and depend on WLLE for civic engagement as well as for music. And then after dark, we had to switch to other kinds of music.
Well, tell us about that station, what the music and the other elements of it.
The station's building is still there. It has a very interesting history in that during its last years, it was actually owned by a Catholic priest who kept it alive. So it has a very interesting history of of its own. But WLLE had wonderful DJs. Sweet Bob was a voice that we heard all the time to tell us about how life was in Raleigh. And it was a station that, again, kept us engaged, because you have to think about when WLLE was at its heyday. It was during the Civil Rights Movement, when so many things were changing all over the country by virtue of people, ordinary people, just standing up for what was right.
And that was that's a sort of a licensing phenomenon. There were these daytime-only stations, but as you point out in the essay, this also had an important cultural and racial overlay, the shutting down after dark had important meaning in African-American communities.
Exactly, but I think the unintended benefit of that, of course, it was intended to be detrimental, but the unintended benefit of that was that we were conversant with the other communities at a time when the world wanted to keep those communities separate. So,
will you read for us?
Certainly. The story is called Of Innocence and Wild Irish Rose. Raleigh was at the cultural crossroads in 1942. Jazz and blues had found their way all over the area because of WLLE Willie Radio. You had to listen to Willie while the sun shone, because the FCC and the city fathers had decreed that the station go off the air at sundown for the common good. Those who lived their lives on the three-quarter time beat of the blues knew better. They knew the fear that the South had of black folk after dark. But after the jazz and blues set with the sun, all of Raleigh's folk, black, white, and indiscriminate, listened to the same music after dark. Then B.B. King gave away to the morning licks and longings of Hank Williams, where country married the blues. It was on one of those nights, when the longing lyrics of Patsy Cline and Connie Francis had taken the night, that Drake Lucas made his winding way home. In the dying scarlet of the western sky, Drake walked slowly down Newbern Avenue, stumbling his way from Sky Lee's place, a rooming house turned liquor house and juke joint that entertained East Raleigh's labor force on most weekends. Drake was still wearing his work clothes, caked here and there with bits of concrete that he finished for Cheyenne Concrete Company every day except Sunday. He paused beside the road to try to wipe the cobwebs from his face, but since the cobwebs were woven by Richard's Wild Irish Rose wine in his back pocket, the task was fruitless.
Sheila Smith McCoy reading her essay Of Innocence and Wild Irish Rose from 27 Views of Raleigh. Yeah, so that raises this question, kind of listening to Connie Francis on the radio after dark and singing the song. So he'd heard it before, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the idea there. What about this? We've heard this idea of this sort of kind of one big family and a small family. Was it two big families? Was there any sense of one big family in Raleigh?
In terms of racial lines?
Racial lines?
Oh, there were certainly places where there was deep connection. But most of the places of my childhood were places where segregation held its sway. So that did not mean, though, that there was deprivation for people of color in Raleigh. We had several rich and vibrant communities, many of which still exist today, though gentrification has certainly taken its toll.
Well, it's interesting. It's always, again, in these cultural and artistic currents where we find the mixing. People were dancing together after mm-hmm. dark. They were listening together after dark, which is why rock and roll became the devil's music, right?
I mean, yeah,
to
exactly.
some extent, especially down here. Tell us more about your essay, though, and what else is happening in that.
Well, it's a short story, and it sort of tells the narrative of a poor working class man whose life is taken very interesting twists and turns, and he's been able to cope because of his best friend Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And it's sort of based on many sort of composite people. I had an uncle who I thought a great deal about when I wrote this story, whose own personal tragedy sort of made him a very happy drunk, but he was somebody who was kind and had the heart that would hold the whole world. But I think one of the most interesting things about my story is it not only narrates what actually was happening in Raleigh. Sky Lee's was a real place, but it sort of takes us in an interesting way to Oakwood Cemetery, where one of the most segregated places were always churches and cemeteries around these parts, and that remains to be true. But I think the ending of the story, which I won't give away, ending in Oakwood Cemetery is quite interesting.
It is a beautiful ending to the story and sublime, and yes, you're right, but don't give it away. Read this book, 27 Views of Raleigh. So, John, yours is also a piece of fiction, apocalyptic fiction at that, although I don't know. Sometimes I think maybe we're there already. Tell us about your story.
Well, what it is it's a chapter from my novel, Good News from Outer Space, which came out over 20 years ago. But it is set in Raleigh in the near future, then near future. It's a science fiction piece, and so it's a little bit different in the sense that in science fiction you create things that aren't there. The future is a different country, the way people have said about the past. And science fiction is also about change. And so one of the things that you do, at least I do in a science fiction story, is if I'm going to have something that hasn't happened, that may not happen, that is strange and perhaps radical, I'll put it in a context that is familiar. That's often how you do this. You take something that's new and put it into a place that's familiar. And so having been in Raleigh for a while when I was writing this book, I thought, well, I'd try to use Raleigh. The other thing that is in there, it's about the religious apocalypse. People believe that the second coming is going to happen immediately. In fact, in this chapter, they think it's happening tomorrow night. The end of the world is coming. When I came to the South, I really became much more aware of and interested in evangelical religion. And not only that, but also the apocalyptic strain of people who read the Book of Revelations as a prediction of things that are happening right now. So that's the context of this chapter.
Will you read for us?
Sure, I can read this. This is from the point of view of George, my main character, who is in Raleigh, which has been taken over by a bunch of religious fanatics under the...
This is science fiction, you say? I'm sorry.
Yes. So, this is people say
Scott Hewler, ladies and gentlemen. Scott Hewler.
Will predict the future. Yes, and so George is trying to find his wife, but in the course of this, it's one day before these people think that the world is going to end, and he comes to Central Raleigh in the middle of a cold. It's in the middle of December, and it's very cold. By the time he reached Capitol Square, he was exhausted. The militia ringing the old Capitol building looked tense. For 3 days, George had been hearing rumors of a massacre of the Saints militia in the West. One of the commanders had had a vision of invincibility. He would march his men outside the lines. The guns of the National Guardsmen would throw flowers. He and his men were slaughtered before they'd gone 100 yards. Their bodies still lay there. Some believed that when the Savior came on Friday night, they'd rise up, truly invulnerable, and complete their sortie, devastating the army of the Antichrist. The militia at the Capitol, however, didn't look reassured by that expectation. Behind the barbed wire and metal stake barricade encircling the State House, young men in fatigues clutched rifles and mugs of steaming coffee. They stood stiffly around trash barrel fires, expecting to be shot by some sniper or raptured out of their bodies at any second. Only the State House and its surrounding park of memorials stood indifferent, as if waiting for this, too, to pass. Across the snow-covered lawn, a man with a chainsaw cut a dead oak into firewood. The snarl of the saw bit sharply through the cold air.
John Kessel reading from his contribution to 27 Views of Raleigh, George Delivers the Goods. When you write a piece like this and you say, you want to root it in something concrete because you're going to go off into space, do you begin, though, to start to have a deeper appreciation and understanding almost accidentally or maybe intentionally as you anchor this story in the details of Raleigh?
Well, I think you have to understand at least some things about the place and the people in order to make it realistic. And I hope I was able to do that. But yes, it's right. I mean, actually, I would ride my bike around Raleigh, picking out places for gun battles. Okay, it was interesting to the different businesses this particular alley on Peace Street that I used in one scene. The more specific you can get, the more it helps you to feel that this is real.
So I think the big question facing Raleigh today, and I'll put it to all of you, is sort of how this development is taking place. We're all sort of amazed at and perhaps certainly pleased by the development of the city and the way it's growing and that it can attract IBMA and other great conventions and people are taking the city seriously. On the other hand, there's Moore Square, and that is troubling to think that, given what we're seeing in these emails, there's a deliberate effort to hide poverty rather than deal with poverty. And I'm wondering if that's kind of the central issue and how you feel about it. I mean, is this a city that's going to be maybe more responsible in handling it than others, Scott?
I hope so. I think it's the central issue of our times, not just for Raleigh. I mean, it's – look, Raleigh has been an incredibly rich city. I've lived here for 20-plus years, and it's been an incredibly rich city the whole time. And – it has had a substantial portion of its population bitterly fight every opportunity that it had to invest in its future, whether it's with infrastructure, whether it's with transportation, whether no matter what it wants to do, it's always the wrong time. We shouldn't invest now. We shouldn't collect taxes. We shouldn't spend. We shouldn't. We shouldn't. We shouldn't. And how can you be a city this successful, this at the top of every list of every good thing, which it genuinely is? I love this city, and then want to take the poorest of your people and exclude them and be doing that in at least semi-official capacities. That's madness.
Sheila?
Well, I think not only is poverty one of the central issues of our time, but how we see people who we see as different from us. They're fetishized racially. They're fetishized as something stagnant or something that you might catch or be in danger from. And I think this gives us yet another opportunity to deal with many of the things that have been formative, not only for Raleigh, for the South, and for our country, that we can't move we can't move beyond unless we take everyone with us.
We will stay tuned. There's a lot of hope. A lot of good things have happened. We can keep our eyes on this and hope for the best. Thank you very much. Sheila Smith McCoy is director of the African American Cultural Center at NC State. John Kessel, NC State English professor, two-time Nebula Award winner. June Spence, author of Missing Women and Others and a collection of short stories, as well as Change Baby, a novel. And Scott Hewler is with us, a local writer and a former Piedmont laureate. 27 Views of Raleigh. You can find out more about that at our website, wunc.org. Up ahead, the music of Green Sky Bluegrass, who you will hear right now. Stay tuned.
Up on a mountain, February in a pretty sight, 6 feet of snow, nowhere to go. Dark night. It ain't the cold that gets you, even when it's creeping in. When he's at work and you're all alone, it's a terrible wailing wind. Down in the valley, there's something stirring. Is that a voice calling out your name? And your paper boy's crying, just bounce him on your knees. It's your last win in the copper country. Last win in the copper country.